Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Jobs, a little bit of retail, and then wild, wild horses. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 16th of November. Good as always to have you along. We are going to do the labor market to start things off today, and I'm going to set the table this way. Every month, we get the big picture update on jobs in this economy. Unemployment sits at 3.9% as of the October report, still historically low, as you know, but up a half a percentage point since April. Every week, we get the first-time claims for unemployment benefits. They came out today. 231,000 people lost their jobs last week, the most since August. And also on Thursday, as in this morning, we get the number of people continuing to file for unemployment benefits. And that is at the highest it's been in almost 2 years. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino gets us going.
It feels like every week for the past 6 months or so, the story about the jobs market has sounded something like this.
We are seeing a little bit of a softening in labor market conditions, not by a huge amount.
Layla O'Kane, a senior economist at Lightcast, says all those little bits of data are starting to firm up.
I think that the softening that has felt tentative for so long feels very real.
And it probably feels especially real if you're one of the now nearly 1.9 million workers on unemployment, says Aaron Tarasas, chief economist at job site Glassdoor.
We certainly see the changing dynamic between employers and workers. You know, the jobs market today is a far cry from where it was, say, in summer 2022.
Back then, workers were often getting multiple offers and commanding big bonuses. Today, Tarasas says the numbers show hiring has slowed.
There are real industries and parts of the country where workers are starting to feel the pressure of a weakening economy.
Like in tech or housing. Surveys from the Conference Board show a drop over the last year in the share of American consumers who say jobs are plentiful, according to the group's senior economist, Selçuk Erin.
That means people who are searching for jobs are having a little bit harder time.
While the economy is still adding jobs, he says the gains have been concentrated in sectors like healthcare and hospitality.
And if you are not in those industries, you are having more difficulty.
A gently but persistently moderating labor market is pretty much what the Fed hopes to see after the wild swings of the last few years, according to Mark Hamrick, senior economic analyst with Bankrate.
Let's call it the normalization of the economy, still recovering from the slings and arrows of the pandemic.
He says there's still a lot of economic uncertainty between global conflicts and an impending election, but so far, so good. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Thursday, a little up, a little down, very little, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. My corporate earnings calendar, yes, I have one. It tells me that it's retailers week this week. Yesterday it was Target and Home Depot. Today it was Walmart and Macy's. And the takeaway, so far anyway, has been pretty consistent. Consumers are getting a little more cautious, pulling back on discretionary items, buying mostly essentials, as Sam Fields reported for us yesterday. Retailers also, though, have been giving us a look at their costs, how much they're spending on inventory and labor and logistics. And the takeaway there is not consistent at all. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, whether retailers' costs are rising or falling very much depends on which retailer we are talking about.
Some parts of the retail business have gotten cheaper lately, like moving merchandise around, says Jason Miller, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State University.
Contract prices for dry van truckload shipments, that's going to be what most retailers are moving their freight with. Those have declined over 20% year over year.
Miller says those lower freight costs help everybody. But some retailers have made their own investments in supply chains to bring down their costs even more.
Many of the retailers, Walmart's a good example, have dramatically expanded the size of their private fleets. So they're handling more of their own deliveries themselves.
Plus, many of the products that certain retailers sell are costing them less, says Brian Yarbrough, consumer research analyst at Edward Jones.
So Walmart mentioned this morning, they've seen a drop off in dairy prices, egg prices, chicken prices.
But other costs for retailers remain high. A big one is wages. Yarbrough says take Home Depot, for example. Earlier this year,
Home Depot came out and mentioned they were going to invest $1 billion in wages and benefits for their employees. And so that's going to be a headwind, right? Because it's a higher expense.
But the timing of wage hikes matters, too. Mickey Chata at Moody's says Target, for instance, didn't see a big jump in costs last quarter, in part because it started raising wages to attractive levels a while ago.
A lot of the employees, their wages are pretty competitive. And so they don't need to do a lot more incremental increase in wages as well.
Going forward, the real determining factor of whether retailers will be able to lower their costs is how much inventory they have on hand, says Brian Eshelman, managing director at Alex Partners.
Those that potentially have excess inventory are having to spend more on markdowns.
Eshelman says retailers with too much inventory will have to bear the cost of discounting throughout the holiday season. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If you haven't yet, you should add us to your podcast inventory, platform of your choice, obviously, or marketplace.org. Give it a try. If you walk or drive, for that matter, through almost any medium-sized or big city in the United States, you're going to see commerce happening everywhere. Yes, sure, brick-and-mortar stores, of course. Also, though, business being done right on the sidewalk or parked along the curb. Street vendors selling everything, ethnic food, clothing, books, and incense. They are highly visible to passersby, those street vendors are. Often invisible, though, at least to the legal and commercial powers that be. In New York City, just for instance, only a fraction of the thousands of food and merchandise vendors selling on the streets can get city licenses, and they face a whole host of challenges from code enforcement to theft and all the other hazards of the street. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our story.
On a crisp fall morning, I headed across the Harlem River from Manhattan to East Fordham Road in the Bronx. Every day, this busy thoroughfare is crammed with traffic and pedestrians and vendors packed in along the sidewalk, selling everything from sunglasses to cell phone cases, jewelry to hot empanadas and fresh-cut fruit. I was there to meet a veteran street vendor, a sort of ambassador for street vendors, at the stall he sets up every morning.
Mi nombre es Vicente Ventimiglia, soy de Ecuador.
My name is Vicente Ventimiglia, I'm from Ecuador. I am 53 years old, and 46 of them I've been on the streets as a street vendor. I come from a poor family. At the age of 6, I went out to sell newspapers because I had to work.
Ventimiglia's wife and sons help out with the vending. The stall, about 10 feet across, specializes in croc charms, the popular little plastic decorations you put on croc sandals. He's got more than 2,000 in stock, selling 8 for $5.
Maintaining such a varied stock not only requires time, but also money. We alternate with various goods. Otherwise, we don't have a chance.
Ventimiglia says his income varies a lot. Early in the pandemic, he was making $4,000 a month selling masks and safety supplies. Now, selling croc charms, he makes $1,000 to $2,000 a month. And he can't sell all the time. I had to reschedule one of our interviews because street vending was rained out.
Todos los comerciantes de aquí siempre...
All the merchants here, we hope to be able to have an established store one day. Because being on the streets, there's no protection from extreme weather in the winter or summer. There's no roof over your head in the rain.
Ventimiglia is a leader with New York's Street Vendor Project, a nonprofit that advocates for legal protections and small business support for fellow merchants, many of them first-generation immigrants.
Immigration, along with the pandemic health emergency, have forced many people, including workers who got laid off, to sell on the street. These people have the potential to be part of the backbone of the economy. When we buy merchandise, we pay our taxes. So we want a proper process with clear rules that involves us street vendors directly.
The Street Vendor Project estimates there are 20,000 vendors in the city, but only about 6,000 permits for them. There are less than 1,000 permits for merchandise vendors like Ventimiglia, and the city's not accepting new applications. Permits can be rented on the secondary market, but they're expensive and not always legit. Ventimiglia says that leaves vendors vulnerable to enforcement action, sometimes prompted by complaints from nearby stores that consider them a nuisance or unfair competition.
Informal street trade is regulated by the sanitation department and also by the police. And the tickets they issue to us, sometimes they're $250, other times they're $1,000. They become unpayable.
But he says even though street vendors are sometimes in conflict with the police, they also rely on them.
We merchants are vulnerable to robberies every day. We've seen everything. Accidents, people being stabbed, street fights, stores looted. This is a particular thing that shapes you as a trader. And when you have 46 years on the street in different parts of the world, the street school becomes a university.
Sometimes a university of hard knocks. Right now, Ventimiglia and his wife share a small apartment with a roommate and their stored merchandise. With fall rains and winter weather coming on, he says they'll probably make about $800 this month, not enough to pay the rent. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's months and months of work and money trying to fix everything.
It just ain't easy being a rancher. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 45 points today. That's a little bit more than a 10%. Closed at 34,945, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 9 points, but less than a 10%, 14,113. S&P 500 picked up 5 points, about a 10%, 45.8. That summit between President Biden and China's leader Xi Jinping does not seem to have done much to convince Wall Street relations are going to improve. Shares in Chinese companies took a hit today. Retailer Alibaba Group down 9.1% today. E-commerce company JD.com descended 1.8%. Checking in on the retailers, Justin Ho mentioned Macy's reported quarterly profits that beat expectations. Ticker symbol M rang up 5.7% today. Here's another quiz for you. Ticker symbol HD. HD, anybody? Come on, it's easy. Home Depot gave back almost 0.6%. Bonds up, yield on the 10-year T-note down 4.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Thank you. Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's a lot about the transition from high school to college that's nice, kind of a positive rite of passage. And then there's the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. Positive it is not. The form is long and the questions about a family's finances are extremely detailed. The government has been giving the FAFSA a makeover to make it shorter and simpler, but that makeover is not yet done, which is relevant because the form for any given coming school year is usually available by October the year prior. The Department of Education announced this week this year's form is going to be ready by December the 31st, which is not October, and it also gives students less time to gather and provide all those financial details, and colleges less time to process it. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
The old version of the FAFSA had 108 questions on it.
Sometimes they were quite obscure.
James Quall is a United States Undersecretary of Education.
Like, did you earn any money as a untaxed member of the clergy?
Quall says the new FAFSA will have way fewer questions on it. Looks like the clergy one isn't going to make the cut. The new form will also make it easier to import income information from the IRS. Quall says this is the biggest redesign of the form since it was created during the Reagan administration, which is why it's taking so long.
For us, it's meant redoing almost every computer system that we have, some of which were 50 years old.
Colleges use the information on the FAFSA to decide how much financial aid to offer applicants. At Assumption University, a private liberal arts school in Worcester, Massachusetts, those aid offers usually start going out right around now. But Bill Boffey, vice president for enrollment, says the delay at the federal level is backing the whole process up.
There's going to be a bottleneck of information to process and awards to get out.
Assumption's asking students to submit some financial information when they apply, so the school can put together aid offers even without the FAFSA. Boffey says that way, students will know roughly how much they'll be paying if they go to the school, and that it likely won't be the sticker price.
We want students to know it's not going to be $67,000 for you to come to Assumption. It's going to be something much less than that.
The compressed schedule also means students will have less time this year to compare the price tags of different schools. Kim Cook leads the nonprofit National College Attainment Network. She says families and college counselors will feel crunched.
A student comes in with 3 aid offers, and how do we help them understand that offer? How do we help them decide which college is right for them academically, financially, socially?
Cook says she believes this year's delay will make next year easier because the FAFSA won't be so daunting and more people will be willing to fill it out. I'm Stephanie Hughes from Marketplace.
The past couple of years, there has been a, relatively speaking, mad dash into EVs. Car makers making electric vehicles, consumers buying them. One car maker, though, has not been moving so fast. Instead of going all in on EVs, the company has expanded its line of hybrids. Gas engines, of course, supplemented by electric motors. We're talking about Toyota here. The market, though, you know, for fully electric vehicles has seemed a little bit shaky of late. And this week, Toyota announced its best-selling sedan, the Camry, is going to be sold exclusively as a hybrid starting next year. Marketplace's Henry Epp has more on whether this half step in the EV transition might actually pay off.
The transition to electric vehicles is in something of a transition itself right now, says Sam Fiorani, vice president at Auto Forecast Solutions.
The market is transitioning between the early adopters and the regular car buyers.
Meaning most people who are eager to pay a lot for high-tech electric cars have already done so, he says, leaving
regular car buyers who won't pay $90,000 for an electric vehicle and don't need to have the latest and greatest.
And even as prices have dropped this year, EVs are a tough sell for many people, says Jessica Caldwell, head of insights at Edmunds.
A lot of consumers are interested in electrified vehicles, but maybe not ready to take the full step towards EVs.
That's where hybrids come in, she says. Drivers get better fuel economy, but don't have to deal with some of the headaches that come with owning a fully electric vehicle.
You don't have to look for a charging station. You don't have to install a home charging station. And for a lot of people, that makes more sense.
Toyota is banking on that, setting it apart from other automakers, which have thrown money into developing and producing fully electric vehicles in recent years. Meanwhile, Toyota, which popularized hybrids years ago with the Prius, has moved much more slowly, says Sam Fiorani.
The management at Toyota has been averse to making that investment, thinking that this whole market is not going to shift as fast as everybody expected it to. And they're being proven right.
Because while EV sales are increasing, they haven't kept pace with the growing EV offerings from car makers, leaving some with growing inventories of unsold cars. Still, in the long run, Toyota does plan to roll out more fully electric vehicles, says the company's communications manager, Michael Moore.
It's an important part of our strategy, but we also think that we should allow the customer to choose how they want to participate in this effort to reduce carbon.
And for now, the company is betting that choice is a hybrid. I'm Henry App for Marketplace.
I don't know what David Brancaccio drives, but I do know you ought to listen to his show, the Marketplace Morning Report, every morning, getting out of bed real early to get to the business news you need to start your day. A lot, maybe even most, of the coverage of agriculture in this economy on this program and elsewhere is about crops, corn and soybeans, wheat maybe. It's all about harvest and yields and planting stuff. The ranching side of agriculture, cattle in particular, doesn't get as much attention, which we are going to fix right now. There are more than 80,000 wild horses out here in the American West, more than half of them in Nevada, which also happens to be, not coincidentally, the driest state in the Union. It's got some pretty harsh country out there, Nevada does. Not much for horses or for cows to eat. And that's making some of those cattle ranchers pretty upset about having to share grazing land with more and more wild horses. Ashley Ahern brings us this story from her new podcast series, Mustang.
If you're a rancher and you want to graze your cows on public land, the government tells you when you can turn them out and when you have to bring them in. Wild horses, on the other hand, roam wherever they want and eat whatever they find year-round. That's a challenge for Brady Vincent. She ranches with her husband and his family in northwestern Nevada. And when their Herefords and Black Angus cows are out on the range, she says they have to compete with a lot of wild horses for grass.
There's nothing for the cows by the time spring turnout comes because the horses have already had it.
And, Vincent says, they're destructive. The horses tear down fences, paw through water troughs and pipes.
It's months and months of work and money trying to fix everything that these mismanaged animals are destroying because everybody's like, oh, you know, they're pretty.
Not far from there, Will DeLong's family has been ranching for five generations, and he's dealt with some of those same challenges. To get to his ranch, you have to drive 70 miles on dirt roads, which can be kind of noisy in an F-350 pickup. DeLong grazes his cows on land he leases from the Bureau of Land Management. In recent years, though, he had to make a tough choice. There was so little grass for his cows, because of all the wild horses, that he kept his cattle at home. That meant he had to buy more hay for them, and hay prices are up.
You know, I take pride in my cattle being in good shape, and I don't want them starving somewhere. Because it won't make me any money, and it won't do the cattle any good.
Before I started recording, DeLong told me he'd rather go to the dentist than be interviewed. But he wanted to talk wild horses, because they've cost him a lot of money in hay and property repairs. So you might think he'd want the horses rounded up. But in fact, DeLong's family's history is entwined with the wild Mustangs here. In the early 1900s, his great-grandfather would catch and sell them to help make ends meet.
If they caught two or three, they were doing pretty good.
Long before the Bureau of Land Management took over wild horse management in the 70s and made it illegal for private citizens to catch or kill Mustangs, DeLong's family was managing the wild horses around here. They kept the numbers in check, catching some horses to train and ride, but also releasing their own domestic mares and stallions to breed with and enhance the wild stock. That meant there was a sort of permeable genetic boundary between domestic horses and wild horses, and his family felt responsible.
They managed the horses so that they were better horses all the time. They wanted to have the best horses they could on the range.
DeLong speaks fondly about the Mustangs his family has trained and ridden over the generations. His father had a beautiful buckskin named Gypsy. A lot of the horses on the ranch today are her descendants. Then there was Pinto Pete, the Mustang DeLong rode as a kid. He says he hopes there are always Mustangs on the range. But right now, there are more than five times as many wild horses in Nevada as biologists say there should be.
When they're at the levels where they're supposed to be at or close to it, they're not a challenge. I don't have any problem. If they're managed in the right numbers, we're used to them. I mean, I kind of like seeing them, actually.
Even if they do compete with his cattle. In Nevada, I'm Ashley Ahern for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. I was in Las Vegas earlier this week on a reporting trip. Stories to come after the new year. But the buzz in town was the Las Vegas Grand Prix, the big Formula One race this weekend. All kinds of hype. Less actual interest, it seems. Saw this on Bloomberg, that ticket prices on the secondary market are going to run you $807. That's down from better than $1,600 apiece. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. And I know I do oil a lot in this slot, but the price drop really has been kind of shocking. Both benchmarks down more than 4% again today. West Texas Intermediate, $72 for a barrel. Gallon of gas, by the way, $3.34 a gallon. A year ago, $3.75. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.